because that's a damn Davis paper. And they are every one of them damned unreconstructed thieves. They are Republicans, loyal to the Union to a man. Another man yelled, and so what then? They have become indoctrinated by professional agitators. Gentlemen, Captain Kidd shouted. A grudging silence, and the three men standing sat down slowly and glared at one another. He did not have very long. He read quickly, flipping newsprint, read of far places and frozen climes, of reports of revolution in Chile, trying to bring them distant magic that was not only marvelous but true. He read of riots in the Punjab, Ray, census-taking, female privacy, all the spilling images of a rumored world weighted with railroads and modernity coming up against ancient tribal hatreds. The tulip, he read quickly, long under guard in Turkey for years, bulbs confiscated from diplomatic pouches, now superseded in value by the Angora goat from the region of Ankara. Pashas object. Angoras smuggled aboard the Highland Star.
Davis will shut down the Dallas Courier under the printing bill, a little blonde man screamed. $200,000 of tax money to hand out to radical newspapers.
Two men got to their feet and came face to face, shouting about the turncoat Hamilton and the corrupt Davis. Others tried to separate them, but they were intent on doing each other damage, and the people separating them, each with a bottom lip stuck out and bent backward trying to avoid blows, became involved in the passions expressed. Women seized their skirts in both hands and got out of the building, and several picked up their husbands' or fathers' or brothers' handguns from the bench outside and carried them away. The U.S. Army sergeant listened for a moment to the shouts about military rule and Austin corruption and the printing bill, and stayed where he was. Finally it came to fists and chairs, and the rainstorm came merrily on as one of the glass cases splintered. The coin can was turned over, and men trod on the money. The hanging kerosene lanterns swung back and forth, and people trampled the chairs down and shook the walls. One man broke a good Wedgwood commemorative plate over another's head. A short man pulled off his belt and began laying about him with the buckle. At the end, the two major combatants, who were the owner of the hotel and the schoolteacher, a young man with spiky, ill-cut hair and pale cheeks inflamed with acne but a determined fighter, struck and twisted themselves out of the door and into the street. All the rest followed. Captain Kidd remained for a few moments at the lectern. He put his chin on his fist and surveyed the wreckage. Then he folded his newspapers and put them in the portfolio and let out a long breath. It was much better up on the Red River, he decided, where all you really had to deal with was the Comanche, the Kiowa, and sometimes the U.S. Army. And up there in North Texas, of course, was Mrs. Gannett. He walked through the overturned chairs and saw all the silver coins flung about on the floorboards, glinting like eyes. It was humiliating, but he would have to grovel on his hands and knees and pick them all up. He would not have done it had it not been for Johanna. He would have said, "You blustering, loud-mouthed jackasses can have them," and he would have walked away. The army sergeant at the door was gone. Fat raindrops spattered out on the dirt street. Men were out there, still shouting at one another with the intermittent voices of peacemakers, crying, "Listen, listen now!" The captain knelt down and began collecting the coins. "Here, sir, you shouldn't have to do that." It was the man with the short black beard who had stopped him on the road. "No, I shouldn't," said Captain Kidd, "but here I am doing it." The man drew up an unbroken chair for him and indicated it with a sweep of the hand. The captain sat down gratefully, his hip joints aflame, and the man began to pick up all the coins himself. "My name is John Calley," the man said. He poured coins back into the can out of his large, calloused hand. He said, "We should not have taken your money this morning on the road. I'm regretting it." The captain nodded and pressed his fingertips against his eyes. He said, "You have fallen in with bad company." "That would be my cousins and my brother." "Still?" "Well, yes." Captain Kidd thought about the apparent ages of the man's companions, cousins and brother, and said, They were in the war.
So was I.
Ah, said Kid. You were young.
No, sir, I was 17.
That's young. The captain had forgotten he himself had seen his 16th birthday at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, firing at the Red Sticks with a rifled Kentucky longbore. He watched the coins drop into the paint can, one after another.
He said, "You should abandon your wayward relatives and decline their illegal activities."
No telling what's illegal these days. John Callie stepped forward to the shelves of suspenders and the collar buttons on cards. He was now dressed in pressed dark trousers and a cutaway, a snowy white shirt with a high collar and a cravat. It was all somewhat frayed, but clean. His dark beard was shorter, neatly trimmed. He wore good boots, the captain saw, with a pair of Arm and Hand spurs. Callie peered at the shelf and said, "Well, be damned, there's one up here." He picked a 10-cent piece up in his thick fingers, delicately. Then he said, "Of course I should, but things change week to week." He poured the money out of his fist into the can. "The legal situation is very unstable. Land titles, everything." The captain realized that John Callie had come in his best clothes to show the captain that he was not, indeed, a filthy, ignorant brigand, but a man gently reared, a serious man, that he wanted the captain's respect. The captain cleaned his glasses slowly on his handkerchief.
"You are not thinking of reading law, are you?" he said.
"Oh, God, no." John Callie stood holding the paint can. "I'm looking for honest work."
"That's an improvement, then, from when I first came upon you."
"Granted."
Callie flushed a bit at the cheekbones.
"And so if one were to read law, where is there solid ground? Somewhere there has to be a bedrock of the law."
Captain Kidd said, "It has been said by authorities that the law should apply the same to the king and to the peasant both. It should be written out and placed in the city square for all to see. It should be written simply and in the language of the common people, lest the people grow weary of their burdens." The young man tipped his head toward the captain with an odd look on his face. It was a kind of longing, a kind of hope.
"Who said that?"
"Hammurabi."
Captain Kidd knew the best thing would be to leave immediately in the night as they had done before. Same situation as Dallas. He had collected his fees for the reading, but yet none of the establishments of Durand were open, and if he were to pound on the door of J.D. Allen, proprietor, to ask to purchase 38 ammunition, it would become known, and the general condition of suspicion would have it, that he was on his way to shoot someone of the opposite party, whatever party that was. He had 8 bullets left for the revolver, and the dove shot, and several pounds of gunpowder, and a supply of dimes. That would have to do. From the banks of the Bosque, by the dim light of the candle lantern, he collected Pasha and Fancy. The rain had lessened, but still it dripped from his hat brim, and his silk topper had become heavy with it, and sat on his head in a damp chunk. He slogged through the wet grass, calling to the horses in a low voice. Little Fancy seemed to delight in her musical bell and lifted her head and jingled it. The horses were rested and full of new spring grass. He led them in. Inside the stave mill, he changed to his old traveling clothes by the light of the lantern. He wondered how many candles they had left. The silence and the lacy patterns that the candle threw out of the intricately pierced tin shade were comforting. He ate a quick meal of black beans and bacon. He called softly, "Johanna, Johanna."
"Captain."
She jumped out of the wagon bed, throwing aside her blankets in a dramatic gesture. She was in her nightgown with hay in her hair and a looping tangle of fabrics and textiles in her hands.
"Look a here, y'all," she said.
The captain turned to her with a smile. She had not yet distinguished the second person plural from the singular, but every day saw an improvement.
"Shh," he said.
"What?"
"I dresser, I jacket, I drawers, I stockin'. Kitten, look."
She held out a bar of soap.
"Shh,
yes, excellent. Who gave you this?" She laid all her second-hand clothes in a neat pile on the tailgate and gazed at them happily.
"Bad water, lady," she said.
"Good, good. Now go dress. We have to leave."
So the young woman who tried to drag Johanna from the Bosque had been stricken with a Christian conscience and had collected clothing for the girl. A dress in yellow and madder carriage check, a jacket of dark green, drawers, stockings, and soap. He ran the hems and edges through his fingers, looked at all the buttons, sewed secure and tight. Clothing was hard to come by, and these were all of top quality. Good. Stricken consciences are an excellent thing, all told. The girl now had three dresses and plenty of underthings. She would not have to meet her relatives dirty and ill-clad. The thought gave him a small, sharp pain in his heart. The rainstorm had all but passed over. Now the sky was clearing. He put the horse's hobbles in his old chore coat pocket, and in the stave mill yard he backed Fancy between the shafts and threw the harness over her back. The gold letters shone in the moonlight. Johanna ducked into the shed row and came carrying, at the last, something wrapped in burlap, but the captain was too hurried to think about it, and so blew out the candle lantern, stepped up to the driver's seat, turned the little roan mare and the light spring wagon with its screeching fifth wheel. They moved quietly out of arguing, fighting, contentious Durand and into the dark of an early spring Texas night, while overhead nightjars moved and sang their low and throaty songs. They swept low like owls and carried the light of the stars on their backs. On down the white moonlit road at a steady trot, 7 miles an hour, bang, 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 Pasha trotting behind, 11 at night when all decent folks were in bed. The captain was not sure what came next, what town, what county, what new trouble. Johanna climbed over the backrest and took up the burlap bundle and returned to the driver's seat beside the captain. She sat beside him and opened it.
"Blekfas!" she cried.
"Oh, no, Johanna, no!"
2 chicken carcasses with bloody feathers and no heads lay in her lap. It was Penelope and Amelia. Dead. Deader than John Wilkes Booth. She smiled down at them. She had twisted their heads off and gutted them, and out of the cavity of one she held up the quivering blob of an unlaid egg which she had saved out of the entrails.
"It's good," she said.
She patted his arm with a sticky hand.
"Blekfas!"
He drove for a few moments with his eyes shut. It was too late to go back and pay the disagreeable broom man, too late to apologize, too late to leave money to reimburse the peevish creature. The captain was now probably thought of in Durand not only as a Davis man but a common chicken thief. He was not sure which was worse. The captain's hand went to his forehead, a dreadful loss of status in the world, in his world. Loss of reputation and the regard of our fellow persons is in any society, from Iceland to Malaysia, a terrible blow to the spirit. It is worse than being penniless and more cutting than the blades of enemies. The captain said in an even voice into which he managed to inject a tone of delight,
"Indeed, clever child, now we have breakfast."
The night was cold and he felt it in his bones and the cool streaks on his cheeks. He realized they were tears, for the trouble that lay ahead of her, for all the years of roofs and walls and the peculiar rules against stealing chickens. He was still tired. He was still drained. She was busy wrapping up the carcasses and singing. She had not the slightest notion of animals as private property, except for horses. Horses belonged to one person. Everything else was dinner at large. She would not hesitate to put a bullet through a calf or a kid. In his imagination, he saw her walking into the Leonberger yard, triumphantly dragging a headless prize foal to please her stranger relatives. She raised her head and saw him shouldering away the tears on his cheeks.
"Oh, captain,"
she said in a falling tone. She reached up and stroked away the tears with her hard and calloused fingertips. Her fingers were gummy with blood, and there were down feathers stuck on them. One drifted down in the moonlight like a falling minute angel onto his coat.
"Leave me alone, Johanna."
hungry,
she said in a decisive tone. Conta hungry. Grandfather was hungry. That was what was wrong. He was hungry. And she would soon have him fixed up with roasted chicken with an egg cooked in the rib cage. He said, Old people cry easily, my dear. One of the afflictions of age.
You all hungry.
She patted the hen's corpse with a hearty feathered sound.
Is all right, Johanna?
Yes, he said. It's all right. 16. They went down the road, which was now the Lampasas Road, with Durand somewhere behind them, and the sun came up bloody red in a clearing sky. The country was high and flat, with only an occasional shift in the landscape. They were exposed. They were the only thing moving in all that horizontal world. They came to Cranfill Gap and stayed the night on the Leon River at a campsite that looked as if it were frequented by convoys of freight wagons. He hoped some would pull in so he could ask for news of Brit, but none came. There were only the deep, narrow tire tracks and flat spaces in the dirt where somebody had thrown out a bucket of dishwater, a dead campfire. They turned the horses out to find what new grass they could, though the freighter's teams had nearly eaten it all up. There he had his roasted chicken and slept heavily. He dreamed of an armed man in the shadows that had about him some terrible noxious smell, and then the man was rising out of the Leon River, amphibious and not entirely human. The captain sat upright and grasped the coat where his revolver was wrapped, but waited it out. This always happened to him when there had been some conflict, first on the Brazos and then Durand. The dreams had just caught up with him now. He knew them of old. Maria Luisa had learned to slide out of bed and stand several feet away and say over and over, Jeff, Jeff, querido, Jeff. And he would come out of an intensely real dream where he was fighting for his life, sometimes at Resaca, sometimes on the Tallapoosa, sometimes in broken streets that appeared to be a bombed city with house-to-house fighting as it had been in Monterey. Perhaps it was something like this that changed the captive children forever, the violence they had endured when they were captured, their parents killed. Perhaps it sank down in their young minds and stayed there, invisible and unacknowledged, but very powerful. He had no one to awaken him now in a soft voice. He let go of his rolled coat and closed his eyes and quieted himself and lay back down and slept again. All the next day they stayed in camp, and he slept most of it away under the awning. Then they drove into Cranfill Gap with its one store, and bought supplies and a little 25-gallon water butt, filled it, and went on. They made 20 miles the next day, a very commendable day's travel. It was because the road was flat and the surface of a good sandy consistency, and Fancy was well rested. The captain felt much better. Their English lessons continued. She could now count to 100 and lace her shoes, when he could convince her to wear them, and sing the first verse of Hard Times. She could tell the hour and the minute hands on his watch. She was full of roast chicken and energy.
Time, Conta. Is time. Is time.
She stood up on the driver's seat and did the rabbit dance, the Kiowa children's dance, and when he finally told her to quit it, she jumped down and ran alongside and found the lid of a tin of salve with a bee impressed on it, and so made buzzing noises as she flew it up and down. They passed only 2 farm wagons and another company of cavalry in all that way. The cavalrymen were being moved from San Antonio to Fort Sill, and the major reminded the captain to be careful. There were raiders, he said, in the hill country.
Then why don't you do something about them? The captain said.
I'm under orders, sir. We don't just go wandering about and do whatever we like. The major pressed his heels to his horse and rode on. Johanna sat quietly in the back and watched after them as they went on north. They camped near the town of Evant, and he felt entirely recovered. At Lampasas was a great good spring of water. He had passed by there several times. It would be a good place to shake out their blankets and take their ease. They were now in a high flat country where trees were scarce and the brush all spiky with thorns and new leaves. 4 years ago he had come up this road to North Texas. It was a year after Maria Luisa died. He had moved out of that graceful Spanish town of San Antonio with its two-story stone buildings and the ornate cast-iron balconies, their cottage roofs shingled with slate. The old Spanish houses all had their backs to the river. The owners of those homes carefully kept record of their descent from the original settlers from the Canary Islands, who had come in 1733, the Betancourts, the Reales. They had retreated behind polished wooden window bars. They retreated into the cool of tiled floors, into the gestures of fans and mantillas and morning masses at San Fernando, increasingly hemmed in by German Catholics and Irish Catholics in the pews, people with incomprehensible languages. Spain, daughter of light, defender of the faith, hammer of the Moors, sadly faded. He recalled excursions on the river, the girls so like their mother, with gray eyes and dark curling hair, and boats passing by offering melons, the immense cypresses, the one that was 100 feet tall, knee-deep in the San Antonio River. Joyous memories. When he met her, he had been setting up his own print shop on Plaza de Armas, slinging ink and type, deeply engaged in the process of making words appear on paper. He could pick up a stick of type and read it backward. He knew from the sound of the patent if it would be a good print or not. He knew his inks and his papers. He delighted in these perfectly printed messages to the world, even if he were not carrying them personally. What good was a beautiful town like that when she was not there? He turned his face to the sky in an effort to clear his head. They went away and never said another word to you again. In some strange way it made him mad. Not a word, not a sign. No messages from the other world. Or perhaps there were signs and he did not see them. He watched two Caracara eagles sailing on their black pirate wings, their red hoods and white vests, and heard Johanna singing Hard Times. Is the song and the sigh of the Willie. Weary, he corrected her, smiling. Yes, Captain, it's Willie. Sigh of a Willie. They were only a few miles from Lampasas now. Around them the creosote bushes were stiff as bones. Their rounded leaves vibrated in the wind. To the north, streams of cirrus were like a frosted sandstorm, veils of high-born mist poured out of the polar regions, perhaps more storms to come. Soon they would come to the hill country. It was scored by deep canyons and high bluffs, clear streams cut through layers of limestone. There would be more cover there for raiding parties of Kiowa and Comanche, but they would deal with that when they came to it. They pressed on. The wheels of the excursion wagon lifted a spume of dust in yellow and pink. For a long time he could see no other wagons but themselves. But after a while they came upon an elderly lady in a gig. He could see it from a long way off as a jiggling dark roundish thing like a beetle that resolved itself into a vehicle with the quavering legs of a long bony horse pulling it. An accordion top rose over the two wheels.
"Well, here is somebody," she said.
She pulled up beside them. She was trim and small and wore a new-fashioned pancake hat in straw tipped rakishly to one side. Her white hair was done up in a roll all around the bottom of her head, and she wore tight brown driving gloves.
"Yes, ma'am, and where are you going?"
"I am going all the way to Durand. I believe I can make it in 3 days. People have tried to discourage me from this journey, but I ignore them. I have a lawsuit to pursue."
"I see," said the captain. "From?"
"Lampasas."
"Then you will do me a favor, please."
He reached down for his canvas bag of coins.
"I would be obliged if you would take these 2 50-cent pieces to the fellow at the stave mill there in Durand, the one that makes the brooms."
"That animal," she said, "whatever you are paying him for, he doesn't deserve it. I have half a mind to refuse."
"I wish you wouldn't. We inadvertently came away with two of his hens, and I would not be known as a chicken thief. It has been bothering me."
"There is no chicken in Texas worth half a dollar in silver, sir."
"I consider it an apology of a sort."
"You have a tender conscience."
"Chicken thieves are not highly regarded."
"True. Give it here, then."
He stepped down and brought the coins over to her.
"Many thanks," he said. He lifted his sweat-stained old field hat.
"And where are you going?"
"To Castroville," the captain said. "I'm a seed buyer."
"Very well. That girl has a peculiar stare. Is she disturbed in her mind in some way?"
The captain got back into the wagon and picked up the reins from the driver's post. "No," he said. "I wish you a safe journey." At noon, he put the saddle on Pasha. He would ride alongside the pack horse's head. This was not friendly country. As he put the saddle on, he finally gave in to old age and reached for one of the sheep fleeces out of their stack of blankets and threw it across the saddle seat. So much more comfortable than the hard leather. Johanna watched, her dark blue eyes mild and understanding now that the strange old woman was gone. He snapped a lead on a ring of Fancy's driving bridle and held the lead in one hand as they went on. Their water bottles were full. It would do. They would be at Lampasas soon. Pasha's easy, smooth walk was a joy to ride, and the captain could not help but pat his neck and fool with his mane and try to get it to lie all on one side. There was quite a lot of trouble in Lampasas. He knew this from when he had passed through years earlier. It was one of those feuds between two families, each with a large number of sons. It seemed to be one of the rules or laws of human nature. The boys all grow up together, and then they become young men, and they fight, at first in play, and then somebody gets hurt, and before you know it, the revenge drama is on. Around them, the dun-colored pelt of grasses shone in the thin sunlight as if it were studded with mica and quartz, and now, with the days growing longer, the first green shoots grew up beneath. He began to see more people on the road going toward Lampasas. As best he could calculate, it was a Saturday, and perhaps the people in this region found it their custom to come to town to shop or celebrate or seek out company on a Saturday, and stay all night to sleep off a hangover or go to church in the morning or both. It was now the second week in March and a time of tender growth, when it slowly dawned on people that the world would not always be cold and brown. This high-level country was like something unexpectedly and suddenly loved, and responding to the bounty of young rain and longer hours of sunlight. "Awake, awake, ye drowsy sleeper." The wind was fresh and wet. They drove through the brook crossing of the Lampasas River. As in all semi-arid regions, the green was all in the riverbeds, the ravines, the stream crossings, where water gathered and the wind sailed overhead. Thick colonies of carrizo cane grew in the little valley of the Lampasas, and they shook their glossy plumes in concert. When they reached the level again, the captain and Johanna came across a group of four men on horseback, with stampede strings hanging down their backs and hair tassels at the end of the strings. They were all armed. They pulled up their horses, strung straight across the road. They were the people now being called cowboys, an occupational specialty that moved into place as the buffalo were shot in their millions. He pulled up Pasha and Fancy. Johanna would be troubled, and so he got down and came to stand beside her where she sat on the front seat. After a moment's stillness, she stood up and vaulted over the backrest with her skirts flying and dropped down in the wagon bed between the water butt and the box of food and cooking supplies. She took to the horongo as an otter slides into his hole.
"Curative waters," said one of the men.
"Bullet holes," said another.
They wore broad-brimmed hats against the relentless sun, the brims shading the V of skin showing in their open shirt collars. They carried riatas at the right-hand side of their saddles, all of them right-handed. They were riding Mother Hubbard saddles with big flat horns and a flank cinch. Bunches of piggin strings tied on the left side.
"Where are you all coming from?"
"Durand," the captain said, "and we are headed to Castroville, 15 miles west of San Antonio. Would you like me to get out a map and show you?"
"No, sir," said another. "I know where it is. Shooter Weiss gets seed from there."
He paused.
"I don't know how to spell his name. He's a kraut."
"Then it would be S-C-H-U-T-E-R," said the captain. "Now, is there any particular reason you are blocking my road?"
They turned to one another, and their horses shifted. They were small horses with thick, long manes and tails that swept the road. Mustangs. The horses had sloped back ends like whippets.
"There's been a lot of raiding between here and Castroville," said one. "The Comanches and the Kiowa are driving people out of the hill country. They got cover down there. Can't see them coming like up here. It's almost empty down there. People driven out. You'd best take care."
"I will."
"Well, are you going into Lampasas?"
"That's where this road goes, and since it is apparently the only one, I did not contemplate riding straight off into the trackless wilds of Lampasas County. Is there some other road you would recommend?"
The tallest one among them said,
"Sir, I remember you from when you read your newspapers there one time in Meridian. I was most interested to hear all the news. So I'll tell you what. You might not want to go into Wiley and Toland's saloon. It's called the Gem. I'm telling you because you ought to know that the Horrell brothers find refreshment there when they are not out shooting down Mexican persons."
"You don't say. And they would object to my appearing there?"
They all looked at one another.
"Tell him," said one.
"Well, then," the tallest one said, "they are all wrapped around the axle about the Eastern newspapers, the ones that show engravings of cowboys, and they think they ought to be appearing in them. And if you show up to read the news, they are going to start hassling you to read about them."
"You are joking."
"I'm not. They are mentally not very fast. They are, every one of them, one brick short of a load. And when we heard of you coming, I said, well, by God, excuse me, young lady." He touched his hat. "That there must be the captain come to read his newspapers. And so, me and my brothers, we heard you read in Meridian one time, and we were impressed by all the happenings everywhere and everything, and we sure liked your reading."
The others nodded. Johanna saw the man touch his hat and look at her and wondered what it meant. Perhaps a warning. He might throw it at her. He might be directing a curse of some sort at her.
"You are very kind," said the captain.
"And I said, I bet the Horrell brothers is going to expect themselves to be in the Eastern newspapers, and when they are not, they are going to raise old Jack with the captain. And besides, there's going to be some kind of a meeting about a farmers' union and a dance, and they get all excited. Benjamin starts in stuttering."
"That's thinking ahead," said one of the others. He turned, loose and supple at the waist, to keep the captain in view as his restive little horse spun to the left in a quick move to unseat him. He kept it going right on around and brought it back to where it had been in the first place, facing the captain, and said, "Quit that, you son of a bitch!"
He touched his hat. "Excuse me, young lady." Johanna sat with a stilled face inside the Harango, her favorite cave of red wool, her magical protection.
"I appreciate your concern," the captain said.
"Happy to be of service," said the tall one. "We are busting cattle out of the brush over there on Bean Creek, and we come across old Mrs. Becker going north on the Durand Road, and she said she seen you, and you was worried about some stolen chickens. So we came riding back to find you."
"Ah, well, a minor matter," said the captain.
He stood beside Pasha and patted his jaw, sat his hat lower on his forehead.
"Yes, sir. So my brother here said, well, that's Captain Kidd, and we'd best leave our work and go warn him. Those cows can stay laid up one more day. They ain't going to get no wilder than they already are."
Another brother said, "Not possible."
A third said, "We'll be around here somewhere, you know, for the night."
Kidd nodded slowly. "You have no bedrolls," he said.
"Yes, sir, well, we just lay down on the ground and sleep."
"I see."
The captain was silent a moment, puzzling over the Horrell brothers, people whose minds were lost in such delusions, such avid desire for worldly fame.
"And what about the English newspapers?" said the captain.
"Do they expect themselves to be on the front page of the London Times?"
"Sir," said the taller one, "the Horrells don't know there is a England."
"Well, thank you so much for this excellent information."
The captain stepped into the stirrup and was proud of the fact that at age 71 he could step up from the ground onto a 16-hand horse. With some pain, but no flinching, he swung into the saddle. Clearly, there was no question of doing a reading at all. He said, "I will be sure to park my traps and gear and this delicate young lady near by the springs, and never stir until I can get the hell out of Lampasas." No, 72. He had just turned 72 on March 15th, yesterday, as he had turned 16 just before Horseshoe Bend, and at that time it would have been beyond belief that he would even live to see this age, much less be traveling along a distant road far to the west, still in one piece, alive and unaccountably happy. 17. He had decided to avoid the Horrell brothers at all costs, but the Horrell brothers found them. The captain was unlimbering where they had parked beside the beautiful Lampasas Springs and the giant live oaks that surrounded them. The spring was in a low place, one of the soothing green low places of this high and dry country, and made a reflective pond. The surface tossed glittering reflections against the trunks. On one side was a stand of carrizo cane, graceful and green. It had tall plumed heads. Great limbs overhead were alive with birds on their spring migration to the north, lately come up from Mexico. The quick and nervous robins, the low song of a yellow oriole, painted buntings in their outrageous clown colors. The Horrell brothers sat on their horses and watched as the captain and Johanna began unloading their gear. They rode good horses, copper-bottom breeds, steel-dust lineage. The captain could see it in the lines of their bodies. They sat and watched Pasha narrowly as he grazed in the long grasses at the verge of the spring. The live oaks were high overhead, and the evening breeze moved over the surface of the water. The captain ignored them.
"You're the man that reads the news."
"Yes, I am."
"Well, how come we ain't in the news?"
"I don't know," the captain said. "I don't write the newspapers."
"I'm Merritt Horrell, and this is Tom, and he's my brother, and these are my other brothers here, Mart and Benjamin and Sam."
The five brothers wore various articles of dress that had been pieced together out of military uniforms from both sides, missing buttons and faded to an unvarying slate color. One had two different kinds of stirrups, one metal, one wood, and none of their hats seemed to fit. The youngest, or at least the smallest, no more than 14 by the look of him, wore a derby far too big for his head, and the captain realized the boy had stuffed the inside band with rags or paper to make it fit. It seemed suspended over his small head. Whatever woman had raised these five boys must now be in the county asylum, if Lampasas County had one, and if they did not, they had best build one soon.
"Enchanted, gentlemen," he said. "Maybe you are in the news. You could well be in the news back in the East, say Chicago or the little one-sheet paper in Ball Ground, Georgia. Just think." The captain shook out his newspapers. "Perhaps London or even California."
"Well, we should be," said Merritt.
He had a dull stare that was also strangely intent.
"We killed a right smart of Mexicans. You'd think they'd put in something."
He took off his hat and slapped the edge of his hand into the crown to straighten the crease. He looked as if he had combed his stiff yellow hair with a skillet. Kid nodded and said,
"And nobody objects to your killing a right smart of Mexicans?"
"Ain't nobody."
Merritt replaced his hat and then crossed his hands on the saddle horn.
"Governor Davis chucked out everybody that was with the Confederacy and never replaced them. Some army people come around sometimes. I guess they would object, probably."
"Could be."
The captain reached for a roll of rope and turned and strung it between two trees and began to throw the blankets over it to air them.
"Would they be doing a wood engraving of us?"
"I have no idea."
He looked up and saw Johanna on the far side of the spring, watching from the carrizo cane. This surprised him. She could move so silently when she wanted. She was an apparition of flying hair and bare feet in the deepening shadows. The cane plumes rose and fell with the chilly breeze all around and above her head.
"Well," said Merritt, "come to the saloon in town. It's called the Gem. The other one is the Great Western, but come to the Gem and read your news. Tellin' how we pursued the hated red man and everything, how the Higgins brothers cruelly murdered, etc., despite Davis's pitiless state police and like that. I hope you don't mind if I'm late."
"No, sir, not at all. You come any time. If people don't want to hear you read about us, well, then we would not object to them leaving."
And so he did not go, but sat up and waited, and before 9 o'clock, by his hunting watch, he could tell from the noise in town the Horrells were probably drunk. He could hear them all the way from the Springs, sounds of music and shouts, far away and thin. He watched the night world and heard its sounds. He smelled tobacco smoke. He watched Pasha. The horse lifted his head from his grazing and stared across the spring at what Kid guessed were other horses, but did not call out. The captain saw the glow of a cigarette. The Merritt brothers were there, and guarding him and Johanna as they said they would. They would take turns, watch on watch. He did not sleep at all that night, but sat leaning against a wheel with his revolver in hand, and they left before it was daylight. 18. They came south into the hill country at last, and here everything was still. He rode Pasha and put a sort of blanket saddle pad on the pack horse under the harness, and the butcher knife in his waistband as well as his revolver. If the raiders came, he would cut the pack horse out of the harness and throw Johanna on the saddle pad, and they would run for it and abandon the wagon. Perhaps looting the wagon would slow them down. The Comanches mostly came from the north, down from the Red River, across the open arid country around Lampasas and Fort Hood. The dust they raised could be seen for miles, and so they skirted the towns and forts. When they came on south to the hill country, there was concealment and water and isolated farms. They loved the hill country with a raider's passion. Here was fighting, and here was loot, with no soldiers to stop them. The world fell away from beneath the wheels of the curative waters wagon, valley after valley, ridge after ridge falling away to the blue horizon. As they came to the top of a rise, he kept carefully to one side of the road so they could not be skylighted and stopped. He would sit for 15-20 minutes at a time, looking and listening for signs of life, for raiding parties. He listened for the quarreling bark of a squirrel disturbed by riders. He watched the buzzards circling overhead, looking for both the tight spiral that meant a dead body somewhere, a carcass either human or animal, and also for their sudden dips, for they were curious birds and would drop like stones on those remarkable wings to inspect something new or unusual. Johanna watched as well. She did not play with her cat's cradle or make up sentences in English. She wore the confining shoes and laid the shotgun long ways at her feet. He did not smoke his pipe, the distinctive odor carried for long distances. And also he took in the air for the scent of others' tobacco smoke. Nothing. The wind had dropped. From the rises he inspected the tops of the trees below, both before and behind the rise, the live oak and the bur oak, the occasional hickories and ravines, for movement that was not made by the wind. Nothing. So they went on. He kept the pack horse's lead in his hand. They started in the early morning when the stars told their way from east to west. They passed abandoned farms, little cabins with stone fencing here and there. Some had been burned down. They came through the red granite country north of Llano. Mountains of red and pink granite. The valleys were starred with Mexican hat and gay feather waving in tall magenta rods, blue bonnets by the acre. It was flowering time in the hill country, new grass for their horses, tender growth for the white-tailed deer, and at night a ringtail cat with its 16-striped tail and bat ears and eyes big as buckeyes carefully raised a kernel of corn from the horse's spillage. Lifted the kernel to its cat mouth while they silently watched. It sat curious and fearless at the farthest edge of the firelight, while Johanna whispered to it in Kiowa, inflections of delight. They came to a destroyed cabin, and he pulled up and then went inside. Broken cups and pieces of dress material torn on a nail. A doll's body without a head. He dug a .50-caliber bullet out of the wall with his knife and then carefully placed it on the windowsill, as if for a memento. Here were memories, loves, deep heartstring notes, like the place where he had been raised in Georgia. Here had been people whose dearest memories were the sound of a dipper dropped in the water bucket after taking a drink, and the click of it as it hit bottom. The quiet of evening, the shade of the devil's trumpet vine over a window, scattered shadows, gently hypnotic. The smell of a new calf, a long bar of sun falling into the back door over worn planks, and every knot outlined. The familiar path to the barn, walked for years by one's father, grandfather, uncles, the way they called out, "Horses! Horses!" How they swung the bucket by the handle as they went at an easy walk down the path between the trees, between here and there, between babyhood and adulthood, between innocence and death, that worn path and the lifting of the heart as the horses called out to you, how you knew each by the sound of its voice in the long, cool evening after a day of hard work. Your heart melted sweetly. It slowed, lost its edges. Horses, horses! All gone in the burning. Once at evening they came downhill to a stream crossing where the clear water made its way between great curving bluffs. Level strata of limestone and stripe after stripe carved back into a deep hollow with the big trees hanging down from overhead. It was like being in a tunnel. Maidenhair fern in bright lime-colored bouquets grew out of the limestone where water seeped through, and it smelled of water and wet stone and the green fern. There was a small spring house made of logs backed into the hollow. He looked into it. Little troughs carved in the stone for milk jugs, a square pool for cheeses and perhaps for meat in metal containers. The water was cold. There were deep holes of water here. Quite clear. A big one, just downstream of the crossing. From a distance they heard somebody shouting, over the hilltops or from a hilltop. In what language, he could not tell. He stood still for a long time and listened. Then the shouting stopped. He and the girl sat in silence for a long time, but it did not begin again. Nevertheless, she needed a swim and a bath with the soap. And so he backed the curative waters wagon into a very small valley that led into the larger stream. He unhitched Fancy and filled the horses Morales with hard corn. He led them far up the narrowing little valley and its thick foliage, and tied them and waited until they had eaten and then left them there, hidden. That would keep them safe for the night, although they would be hard to handle in the morning after being tied up all night. But he could not take a chance on losing them by letting them free to graze. He came back to the running stream and sat with his back turned while Johanna jumped into the deep pool and swam in her bad water lady of Durand drawers and shift, silently, carefully, no splashing. Soap bubbles drifted noiselessly down the stream. He washed his face in a basin and shaved, and at supper, cooking over a small fire quickly doused, they sat eating and listening. Raiding parties of young men had their own laws and their own universe, in which the niceties of civilized warfare did not count, and an old man and a young girl were fair game to them, for in the Indian Wars there were no civilians. After a while, the captain and Johanna went to sit in the spring house and listen to the soft clatter of running water. In the shadows they could keep watch and perhaps sleep a little. The running water was soothing and sweet. Two great live oaks overhung the stream from above. They dropped their leaves one at a time into the water. The new leaves were coming in and pushing off the old ones, slowly, slowly. They were small and hard. They fell like pennies. And looking out of the springhouse window, he saw one of the great drooping limbs overhead begin to shake. Its farthing leaves came down in a light shower. He drew in his breath in a small sound. He thought at first the enormous live oak was at last coming loose from its tenuous hold on the bank overhead and would fall. He had seen it happen once before. The girl woke up and came to stand beside him in the shadow and looked through the minute window. Out of the broad limbs, a figure dropped. It was so startling that it seemed to take forever. A slim young man with long blonde hair fell and fell. He held his bow and quiver overhead with one hand. The moon shone on him as he fell. His hair flowed up over his head like spun flax, a cloud of gold. It was cut short on one side. Kiowa. He struck the water, and thin fans like crystal erupted around him. He then surfaced and skimmed through the water to the bank. He held his weapons over his head. Captain Kidd turned his hand with the revolver in it so that the barrel pointed out. The water reflections made deep blue planes under his eyes. He wondered if she would betray him, if she would call out to the young captive and his fellows who hid above on the bluff somewhere, if this was his last night on Earth. This was what she had wanted so much, to return to the Kiowa and the life she had known, the people whom she considered her people, and their gods her gods. But when he turned and looked into her eyes, she put her hand on his arm. She shook her head once. Then they saw three others drop out of the live oak, one after the other, flinging great screams of water around themselves as they broke the surface and swam to the bank. Soft noises of Kiowa, quiet murmurs. And then they slipped away. Perhaps they both had narrowly escaped death. Death by arrow, death by beauty, death by night. And so they went on south to Castroville. They came through Fredericksburg, a small town in the hill country, beleaguered, nervous, inept at defense. The population was almost entirely German. He had heard it called Fritztown. The main street going through town was wide enough for three or four vehicles to pass abreast and was an open invitation for warriors to gallop straight down the middle and fire in both directions if they wished. Slowly and soundlessly, the evening sun poured its red light down the main street. The lights of the hotel came on. Dust bloomed up at Fancy's heels. The captain took two rooms, as usual, and paid for baths and a washerwoman. The people came around the green excursion wagon to stare when they heard the captain and Johanna's names from the hotel owner. The girl was Johanna Leonberger, a captive who had been redeemed for German coin silver. They had heard about the silver from the grandfather of Bianca Babb, who had brought his granddaughter back from Indian territory. They gave him advice and warnings of how the captives were strange, how they disliked white people, how they had peculiar eyes and had probably partaken of some secret potion or drug to make them so. That was the only answer, the only reasonable explanation. The captain offered to do a reading, even though he knew very few people would come, because so few people here were conversant with English, and especially newspaper English, or where things were in the outside world. It was in the main to help Johanna learn the proper protocol for sitting at the door and collecting dimes. And in reality, the fewer people to attend, the better. It was a practice session. He put up his advertisements and was given the use of the Vereinskirche for that night. He asked for a blacksmith to fix his broken tire, but the local blacksmith had been killed on the road to Kerrville. In her room, they shared a supper of some German dish made of noodles and ground mutton and a cream sauce. He still could not trust her manners in a restaurant. But she carefully placed her napkin on her knee and lifted each bite on her fork straight up to the level of her mouth, and then aimed it straight in. "Is all right, Johanna?" "I suppose that will do," he said. She slurped a noodle until it flipped up and struck her on the nose. "Johanna!" She laughed until tears came to her eyes. She wiped her hair out of her face and addressed herself once again to the food. The captain tried to be stern and then gave up. He set to the dish and the preserved cauliflower to one side with enthusiasm. It had been a long time since he had eaten a well-cooked supper or anything made with milk or cream, and they did not have to wash up the dishes in a bucket.
"That watch," she said. He took it out of his pocket and opened it.
"In 30 minutes," he said, holding it out, "we must go read at 7.
"It is when the little hand there on 7 and big hand on that 12?
"That's it, my dear," he said.
Then he pointed down the hall to the bathroom and handed her a towel.
"Go," he said.
At the Vereinskirche, the People's Church, which was both a church and a community hall and a fort, if need be, he sat her down at the door with the paint can on a fern stand beside her.
"Daima," he said. He held up his hand.
"Sit. Stay." Then he walked out the door, turned, and walked back in and pretended to notice Johanna for the first time, and said, "10 cents?" She understood instantly and pointed to the paint can.
"Daima,"
she said it sternly and with great firmness. And so that evening he read from several Eastern papers while Johanna took up the task of being gatekeeper as if she had been waiting for something like this all her life. She fixed every person who came in with her glassy blue stare and pointed to the can and said, "Daima, 10 cents. A small girl with bottom teeth like a white fence and braided ochre hair and a dress in carriage check. From somewhere she had dredged up yet another word in German, and when someone walked past without noticing her, she cried, "Achtun! 10 cents!" Joy and liveliness had come back to his readings now. His voice had its old vibrancy again, and he smiled as he read the amusing things. The Hindi women who would not say their husbands' names, odd telegraph messages caught by a reporter, and recalled how dull his life had seemed before he had come upon her in Wichita Falls. He saw her bright, fierce little face break into laughter when the crowd laughed. It was good. Laughter is good for the soul and all your interior works. That night he walked back to the hotel with her and put her to bed in her own room. She yawned enormously and said, "Big horse, little horse," wiped her hands on the bed cover, yawned again. Then she fell back on the bed and was asleep within moments. He tiptoed out. He knew that by the morning she would be sleeping on the floor, but still this was an improvement. Their washed and ironed clothes lay in a bundle at his door so that they could be clean and civilized by morning. He thought about how Johanna was being filed down and her sharp edges ground away. The captain sat by his lamp and tried to find articles in his newspapers that were not tied to dates, fluff pieces on chemical discoveries and astronomical surprises. Alphonse Borrelli had discovered an asteroid and named it Lydia, and the Earl of Ross had calculated the surface temperature of the moon at 500 degrees Fahrenheit. That would do in a pinch. He laid out his traveling clothes, the old rough flannel plaid plains shirt, his lace-ups, his clean socks. It was 40 miles of rough country south to Bandera, and were they to be killed and scalped, their bodies would be found bloody but spruce. He broke down the .38, cleaned it, reassembled it. He made a list. Feed, flour, ammunition, soap, beef, candles, faith, hope, charity. 19. Finally, they came into the town of Bandera, where Polish immigrants labored at a sawmill, and lines of freight wagons and their oxen stood in the street to make up a convoy to San Antonio as protection against the Comanche. The great oxen came in teams of 6 and 8 down the main street with their heads tipping from one side to the other with every stride, as if they were listening to some unheard music, a ponderous waltz. The people still believed the red men came only on the full moon, despite all evidence to the contrary, and the moon was now well past full, so the people in Bandera lived in delusions of safety. In Bandera he found that the blacksmith was overwhelmed with work for the freighters, shoeing the teams of oxen and repairing tie rods and beating out carriage bolts on the anvil. So he let it go. It seemed the cracked iron rim would have to hold a little longer.
The captain rented the Davenport Mercantile Building, and for an hour's reading they made enough to get through the final miles to Castroville. He had mined